sun, wondering what went wrong, and falling down on your knees, asking for sympathy, and being caught in between all you wish for and all you've seen, trying to find anything that you feel that you can believe in.
Well, good evening and welcome, friends, to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, whether you're across town or across the globe. I'm your hostess, Karen Tate, and that little snippet that opened the show, that little tease, was a cut from the artist Laura Kane's CD, and it was called In the Sun. Appropriate, isn't it, as we're still celebrating the return of the sun. Well, let me introduce myself to you if you're new to the show, because we do have a lot of new listeners. I'm the author of two acclaimed books, Sacred Places of Goddess, 108 Destinations, and its bookend, Walking an Ancient Path, Rebirthing Goddess on Planet Earth. Folks at the Joseph Campbell Foundation gave my book a thumbs up, and it's been sold in museum bookstores and won an award, so I hope you'll check out my website and learn more about my work. While you're there, please take advantage of the free downloadable meditations. They're my gift to you, my listeners, Advocates of Goddess. While you're there, click on my YouTube channel or check out all the times I've been interviewed and look at all the articles and all the links. It's a pretty awesome website. And if you keep listening until the end of the show, I'm having a contest where you can win some goodies, so stay tuned. Well, tonight my guests are Anne Newkirk-Niven, editor and publisher of Three Goddess or Pagan magazines, and we're going to be discussing the trends in the community and in pagan publishing. Following Anne, you won't want to miss Victoria Javoyan telling us about prana power and the eight key breaths of life, which are exercises for your ultimate physical and spiritual health. But first, a few housekeeping tidbits. I wanted to share with you how excited I am about this new addition to my show. Starting the first week in January, I begin Sacred Salons, or as I also call it, Ritual on the Radio. So if you're a solitary or you just want to spend some sacred time with me, this is your chance. I might even start opening the chat room toward the end of the salon. What I'm trying to do is exemplify insight into goddess-inspired living. I hope you'll tune in and send me feedback, which so far has been good. So let me know what you like and what you don't like. Now, remember, that's always the first week of the month, and whether my show's on a Wednesday or a Thursday night, so it's once a month. And don't forget our other once-a-month gig, Sacred Sundays at the Green Man Store in North Hollywood on Lancashire, if you're in Southern California or near L.A. Our next service for women and men is January 29th at 11 to 1, and the theme is Resolutions and Return of the Light. We have something very special planned for this service, so I hope to see you there. And if you do come, introduce yourself, let me know you're a listener. And for more info, please email me at karentate108@ca.rr.com. And you might want to write down that email address, because you're going to need that if you enter the contest at the end of the show. karentate108@ca.rr.com. And coming up next week on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, we have Starhawk with us discussing her newest book, The Empowerment Manual, A Guide for Collaborative Groups, and also Zohara Hieronymus, author of Kabbalistic Teachings of the Female Prophets, and her newest book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. I think that promises to be a great show that will no doubt help us navigate our inner and outer landscapes. So, without further delay, let me tell you a little bit about Anne, and then we're going to jump in and chat. Anne Newkirk-Niven, well, she's the editor and publisher of three magazines, Sage Woman, Witches and Pagans, and Crone. She's been active in the goddess and pagan communities for over 25 years, and she lives with her family in the suburbs of Portland, Oregon. And we've just been talking about Portland got some snow today. So, welcome, Anne, to the show.
Well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Well, I appreciate it. Well, let's start with you wearing your hat as editor of Sage Woman. How did that come to be, and was Sage Woman your first magazine?
Well, Sage Woman, it was my first project as a magazine publisher, but I'm not actually the first editor or even the first publisher of Sage Woman. Sage Woman started 25 years ago, right here in the Portland metro area. A woman named Carol Shebear started it as a successor to the previous country, Back to the Land women's magazine. I'm trying to remember the name of it now. It's not coming to me. I feel like an idiot. Oh, well, I'll come back to that. Anyway, there was a previous magazine, Woman Spirit, I believe, was the name of it. And that was published for a while, and then it stopped publication, and Carol kind of picked up the mantle. And she published the first four issues of Sage Woman, and then she handed it off to Linnea Weatherstone, who was a Santa Cruz goddess priestess, and published the next, well, let's see, she's published issues number 5 through issue number 23. And then it came to me. My first connection with Sage Woman was actually as the printer. I was working in a small print shop run by myself and my husband in Point Arena, and I picked up a copy of Sage Woman in a women's bookstore in Santa Rosa, California, and we were looking for clients that were compatible with our belief systems and also that would appreciate the fact that we were doing all recycled paper at the time and soybean inks. And so I picked up the phone and called Linnea and asked her if we could print Sage Woman. And then and she said yes, and it was just so wonderful. So we worked with her for a while, and then after a time, Sage Woman was having some challenges as a publisher, and I ended up acquiring it basically.
You had some firsthand knowledge as the printer. So you're the printer turned editor.
That is correct. The first few years I was doing the magazine as publisher, Linnea was working for me. And then after a while that fell apart and she went her own way. And I then hired somebody to be the editor and then ran out of money to pay her. So I took it over actually myself as sort of a, you know, it was sort of like that, or it was going to die, and I didn't want Sage Woman to die, so I took on the job. And I had really no confidence at all that I could do it, but it was one of those things that you do if you have to.
And well, you know, you remind me of so many of us who feel called to do something, and we might not quite have all the training to do it, but we sort of jump in, sort of like the fool of the tarot deck, you know, and
mm-hmm.
we sort of get on the job training, you know, pretty quick.
Oh yeah, I think that definitely fits.
So I would imagine, but you had a goddess or a pagan background though, or I assume or no.
Well, actually, that's an interesting story. I grew up in a Christian home. I was a very devout Christian of a what would now be considered somewhat traditional, but back then was fairly. We were liberal socially, but we were very devout, and we were Methodists. And my first experience with moving outside of that usual realm was when I got tossed out of my Sunday school class. I was in the third grade for questioning theology, which was a little strange, but we changed churches at that point. And so I grew up being groomed for a position as a minister in that denomination. So I went to Lewis and Clark. I got a religious studies major. I spent a summer in Estes Park, Colorado, as a Christian minister in the national parks. And then I went to seminary, and it was actually while I was at seminary that I found a goddess.
Wow,
that may seem.
That's incredible. So yeah. how does that happen? How do you go to Christian ministry to become a Christian minister and find goddess?
Well, I think that I had been kind of like many people say that are adult converts rather than raised pagan. I think I'd been a pagan in my heart for a really long time. It's just that that language was not really available to us back in the 80s so much. People just didn't know about such things, at least not in a very open way. So I had always been very nature-oriented. I had always been very called to more sensory styles of worship. And I considered Catholicism for a while, but couldn't really handle the patriarchy part of it. You know, I really was called to Mary, but didn't feel like I could really put up with the Pope, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And so one day, I think it was my first year, I sat down and read that gateway novel, The Mists of Avalon, which so many of us from this generation found as a method of finding the goddess. And then I was really enchanted and went, oh, wow, that's so wonderful. Wouldn't it be great to be able to be a priestess like that? And then happened to be working in the Graduate Theological Union Library in the New Religious Studies Department and found a copy of Starhawk's book, The Spiral Path, and found out that, yes, in fact, it was possible to believe in the goddess, that there was actually a living religion. And that was a revelation. And for a long time, I considered the possibility of trying to live between those two worlds. In fact, I finished my degree at the seminary and came out of the broom closet to my master's degree committee, which I did not know how that was going to go. I was really concerned, in fact, that that I might be kicked out of the program and not finish my degree, and they were very open-minded and and gave me my Master of Divinity, which has always seemed to me like a silly title because I always have this image of a dominatrix with a bunch of gods carrying. but in any case,
what did your parents say about that, though?
Well, my parents were not really happy. That's another place in which it's funny because I'm a very out pagan now. I mean, I use my real name. My home address is printed in every magazine. That's a requirement of the USPS. I wouldn't do that if I didn't have to. And so a lot of people think, oh, well, that wasn't hard to do that. But at the time that I let people know that I had found the goddess, it was really a step off of the high board, you know, off the deep end, because I gave up what I thought was going to be, which I've been preparing for many, many years, my profession. My family was very devout, so they didn't, you know, it's funny, they didn't take it all that well, but they didn't disown me, and that was great blessing. That was a great blessing.
What I'm curious about is, you know, because, and this is, these are the kinds of questions I like to delve into if you're comfortable with it.
Sure.
Here you were going to seminary to be a minister, but your heart is really, you know, a pagan / goddess heart.
Mm-hmm.
How does someone that's seriously considering making such a commitment, you know, meaning going to seminary, especially a woman, I want to try to understand how does one reconcile the, you know, the patriarchal aspect of it? You know, how does, mm-hmm. you know, how does one, I guess, tolerate, for lack of a better word, the double standard of, you know, how the church sees women versus sees men? Did that give you pause, or was that difficult for you to swallow? Or maybe in your denomination of Christianity, it wasn't so sexist. I'd like to hear a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, you know, this was the 80s, the early 80s. This was in Berkeley, California. So I was attending what was probably the most liberal seminary in the entire United States and possibly the world. I'm not really sure. So the seminary was already very, they were very connected to the concept of overcoming racism, patriarchal sexism, and all those kind of oppressive things. I mean, it was a school where I got in trouble, actually, for questioning the inclusive language policy, because in the school at the time, I don't know if it's still like this, although I suspect it is, you weren't even allowed to use male gender terms for God. All the terms that had to be used in public worship were all completely inclusive of gender. And so, and I only questioned it because I didn't understand how that was supposed to work. But I got hauled up in front of an ethics professor and get yelled at pretty thoroughly about it, because I kind of, you know, stepped outside what were the bounds of what was correct at that location. As far as the deeper issue, I would say that the main reason that I left Christianity was simply because the goddess called my heart. It was not an intellectual decision, it was an emotional one. And I just couldn't find her where I was, which is curious because I'm polytheist. I believe in many gods and goddesses. And as a matter of fact, the only God, male energy that I've ever worked with any success, is Jesus. So I don't talk to him very often, but I still consider that spirit to be part of my path, which makes me a bit of a heretic in the pagan community too. But what I found, I guess, is a more... My religion has always been very personal. I always feel very connected to deity. And so the trappings of the church did irk me very much, particularly the kind of language that's used in scripture. The particular denomination that I was a part of had had women female ministers for many, many decades, and was trying really hard to be not patriarchal. But of course, the stories, however you wish to interpret them, were not contemporary. And so that was a challenge. I finally just left the church because my heart wasn't there anymore.
So did you find
that's just an emotional thing, I guess, more than anything else.
Well, so did you find that that time you spent there, did that serve you in any way in your next career as a goddess pagan publisher?
Well, actually, the curious thing is I would have to say yes. Not because of so much of, you know, the ministry program at that particular seminary, and probably most seminaries, in fact, was very skills-oriented, more than theology-oriented. Now, my Greek exegesis skills I haven't used in 25 years, and they're kind of useless to me at this point, but the skills that I... learned in things like public speaking, in small group, you know, leading small groups, pastoral counseling. Even though I don't act really as, you know, I'm not an active priestess, I was consecrated as a priestess of the God and Goddess shortly after I left seminary by the Fellowship of the Spiral Path, which is a group many people know Diana Paxson is involved with. So that was something I thought I was going to do when I left seminary. I felt I was still going to be a minister. I just felt I was going to be a goddess minister. But what ended up happening was I ended up moving to a very remote place in Point Arena, which is, you know, about 50 miles from the nearest big supermarket and 100 miles from the nearest big city and, you know, almost a whole day drive to San Francisco. So what ended up happening was, instead of having this big public thing, ministry happening, I ended up in a situation where my gifts went into a literary form, which turned out to really work for me because, among other things, I ended up having kids and not being able to be out in the world. So I was, you know, I've sort of been in this... you know, grass-covered tower or ivy-covered tower of a magazine kind of thing as a way of serving the community. And so I kind of feel that the skills I learned in seminary were useful, even though I switched religions.
I see. I see. Let me tell
you. Know, because, yeah. I mean, it's just, you know, it's, I guess, now I understand that there are real theological differences, and I totally grasp that. But people are people, and religious
people. Well, sure.
Ways are religious.
Well, And I mean, look, and there's what the church says versus what the everyday person believes and says and practices, you know. So, and lots of times they're worlds apart. So, personally, I'm very eclectic, and you know, I can totally get that. So then, how many years now have you been doing Sage Woman?
I've been doing Sage Woman since 1989, I believe it is. I'd have to actually look it up because I know how old Sage Woman is. I just haven't quite figured out. I've been the editor since issue number 25, and we just put out issue number 82.
Wow.
So it's been, you know, 20-plus years, something in that realm.
So in that
a long time.
so in that long time, Anne, what do you think have been the biggest changes you've seen in the community?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I'm glad you ask it. It's Sage Woman is about community, and so are the other magazines to some extent, but lesser. So Sage Woman is probably kind of the core thing that I connect to and am trying to create a sense of goddess community. Several things have changed. One of them, I would say, is that people are much more aware of just the concept of goddess or concepts of there being different ways of doing religion. When I was coming up, nobody said they were a witch unless they were really radical. There certainly were our foremothers, people like Zee Budapest, people like Starhawk, who were way out there and in the forefront. But nowadays, it's not that uncommon to meet mm-hmm. people who will say they're Wiccan or say they're witches or say they believe in the goddess. So that's one of the biggest changes, is that the goddess community and the pagan community, even if individuals are still constrained by circumstance about sharing their beliefs, the community as a whole is much more public. It's just a huge difference than when I came up. That's one thing. Another thing I think is that there is, what I see myself is that there's less of a separatist attitude than there was. I think that that's generational. Women who are a little older than me, I'm 53, came from a time when the institutional sexism of our society was much more blatant, and they were fighting it in a really vigorous way. And as a result, a lot of the early Sage Womans are pretty separatist. I mean, we still have a policy where we publish only the work of women. That's very, I think that's really important to this community. And so I'm cool with that, totally. But it was more sharp, more sharp-edged. I'll give you a concrete example. When about 3 or 4 years after I started being the editor of Sage Woman, I had a really rough year, and I'm a chronic sufferer of both clinical major depression and also panic disorder. And so sometimes I have breakthroughs or breakdowns, whatever you want to call it. And I got into a really dark period. And at the time, I turned to an animal type spirit, a unicorn that I had connected to when I was a child and suffered some pretty severe abuse. And then I came to the realization that this particular being was actually a manifestation of the Christ spirit. And then I wrote about it in my editorial, which was a little naive, I realize now. And it was hugely controversial. I got a lot of people who were very, very angry and upset that I had even mentioned that name. In Sage Woman's pages, they were really, really
extreme.
It was, oh, the one that sticks out to me the most was a letter I received that said, "Thank you for poisoning the sacred well."
Oh, wow. That's extreme.
That's really extreme. That one went pretty deep. And what I have seen over time is, although there is still a great deal of anger about the patriarchy and about the way that the Abrahamic faiths feed into and create, and, you know, especially with the dominationists, the political right-wing Christians that are showing up nowadays.
Mm-hmm.
There's still a lot of anger about them, but there's less of an anti-Christian bias.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, there's more of a welcoming and an understanding, I believe, in the goddess community that men are not the sole creators of the problem. Here's another example. Fast forward 20 years from the last story. I got it in my head. I just channel the themes. I just announce a theme, and I don't know where it comes from. Really, I don't. I have to be careful, though, because I always live them out. So the death and dying issue just about killed me. So in any case, I came up with a theme last spring and put it out, because I'm now on Facebook, put it out to my Facebook readers, gingerly thinking that there might be a real backlash at even suggesting this. And the theme I suggested was to have an issue of Sage Woman called Women and Men, in which we discussed sort of the male-female dynamic. And I was very shocked and surprised that the response was 100% positive. People just jumped up, and women just jumped up and down and said, please have this theme. Now, I haven't done the theme yet, so I have no idea how it's going to turn out and whether it will be controversial or whether it will be really beloved or whatever. But that's a huge change, I think.
Okay.
That would not have happened 20 years ago.
Okay.
Maybe it's because gender's gotten more fluid.
Well, and maybe also, too, because, you know, there are more people talking about balance, you know, the sacred masculine and divine feminine. That has something to do with it. You know, they realize that there has to be a balance, and just swinging the pendulum the other way, you know, just perpetuates the same problem.
I don't know. It could be that. I do think that gender politics have changed a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the hot button in the goddess community has to do with transgender. You may or may not know about the big hoorah at Pantheacon last year.
Oh yeah, I heard.
Yeah. So we haven't actually taken on that particular issue in the magazine yet. But I think that it's just not quite as black and white as it used to be, I think.
Right,
and
right.
So that to me from my personal point of view, I appreciate that because I love Sage Woman. It's a very important part of my life, and I'm very happy that it is woman only, especially
mm-hmm.
since I have three sons and a husband.
Yeah, you need a little bit of that female energy.
Oh, I sure do.
So, Anne, we probably, we've already, believe it or not, talked like about 25 minutes. The time goes so fast. So we probably have, I assume, maybe 10, 15 minutes before my second guest calls. So I just wanted to give you sort of a time check there, because I know
no problem,
we want to talk
sure.
about some other stuff. Tell me, you know, briefly about the other two magazines.
Sure. Witches and Pagans is the outgrowth of a long series of magazines, which we finally think we've nailed down. The first one was Green Man. We were trying to make a male counterpart to Sage Woman, thinking that, you know, since we had, you know, my husband involved in, you know, all these male children, that we needed to do that. That was that hound would not hunt, as they say. So it morphed into a magazine called Pangaea, and then we had a magazine called New Witch, which we wanted to do for next generation pagans. And eventually we came to the conclusion that what had happened was that, A, we had too many magazines and we couldn't really handle them all, and, B, that we were bifurcating the community between younger and older pagans. So we merged them together, which was wonderful. Witches and Pagans is trying to be something of a pagan journal of record, something that covers the entirety of the community. And it's not so much on-the-minute news, but sort of deeper issues. We just, for example, did an issue on Law and Chaos. Turned out just to be all about law, really, and it was had articles about the work of pagan civil rights was a very large part of that particular issue. And the one we're just about to publish happens to be all about heathenism and northern traditions. That's the first time we've done a tradition-centric magazine. So mm-hmm. it's more journalistic.
Okay.
And has a lot of people in it. Crone is our third magazine. We picked up Crone. A good friend of mine, Ann Kralkamp, published a magazine called Crone Chronicles in the 80s and early 90s. She closed it in 2000. At the time, I was too young to pick up that mantle, and so it lay dormant for about a decade. And then a couple of years ago, I approached her and said, I think it's time for us to bring, you know, a new magazine for the Crone consciousness. And she worked on the first couple of issues with me, and now I'm the editor of that title as well, because she's moved on to other projects.
I'm curious if you're feeling any pressure with the closing, of some of the big chain bookstores. Are you feeling any pressure to take your magazines and have them be strictly online?
Well, yes and no. What I would like to say about that is that we are very committed to paper, and our readers have made it extremely obvious to us that they do not want us to go all digital. The magazines have been available digitally as PDF downloads. You can buy them from our site and read them on pretty much any of those devices that people have these days. We have most of them ourselves because we have to, you know, play test them. So you can read them on an iPad or read them on a Kindle Fire and so forth. But our readers seem to really value ink on paper and have told us so on numerous occasions. And I would say that approximately 95% of our readers are still subscribing or buying in the bookstores on paper, and I don't know when, if ever, that will change. I'm not sure. There seems to be something about holding at your hand. People tell me this over and over again, that they value that.
Well, you know, I, for one, love to soak in a hot tub and a bubble mm-hmm. bath with a book or a magazine, and I don't think I'd do that with a Kindle. There's something about turning the page,
you know? Yeah. There's also something, I mean, we do make it available digitally because people ask us to. If it was just up to me, we wouldn't because I don't like to read things that way. But people came to us and they said, you know, I would really like to be able to read this. So we're doing it. But what we've seen is that people seem to still enjoy this other method. Now, I expect in the next, I'm going to say, 10 years, that we will see more of our readers being digital readers. But we have every intention of keeping ourselves available in print. And I think that there's also, that's something that we're really committed to for another reason, and that is that I see, and I've seen other people have agreed with me on this, that there is a real class problem with digital media in that you have to have the device, which is a real barrier to some people. It's a barrier financially. It can be mm-hmm. a barrier. I mean, some people are just not are not there and don't want to be there. And
some people would
want to be there but can't afford to be there. And
no, I understand.
You can pick up a magazine, and it's not a $200 investment.
Right. So if when the chains started to shut down, did that force you to go to primarily subscriptions? Because I would imagine that must have hurt your business, not having as many shelves to have the magazines on.
Well, it definitely was a huge blow. Last September, we actually started a Borders Rebound campaign, because Borders was the one that shut down. We are still in Barnes & Noble. And we're still in Whole Foods and, a lot of independent stores. So we still have, you know, really solid circulation in the stores, but there are a lot less of them now. So we put out to our readers that we really needed to get some money together, because these checks that we had depended on from the bookstores were not going to come. And that put us in a big cash flow crunch, and our readers responded. Over 300 Sage Women readers donated, and we raised our $12,000 goal and far surpassed it, as a matter of fact. And so that was a huge psychological lift, because to tell you the honest truth, I was thinking about, you know, polishing up my resume, which would have been hard to polish, but you never know what you can do, you know, if you have to. But I really didn't want to stop doing Sage Woman. I really didn't.
Well, and that must have been a boon to your heart, too, to
it was.
See that.
And the letters, yes, it was a balm. I mean, it was really wonderful. And it's happened once before. In 1998, one of our major distributors went bankrupt, and we had to resort to fundraising at that time. And so it's obvious to me that that our readers value what we're doing. And that's kind of where the pedal meets the metal. I mean, we've taken 65% pay cuts since the recession to keep the magazine going.
So, Anne, besides Circle News, are there any other, I'm going to use the word major, and I don't know if that's the correct word, but, you know, widely circulated pagan goddess-oriented magazines out there anymore that are, you know, that are in the bookstores, you know, not just an online thing?
As far as I know, no. As a matter of fact, I have seen dozens of pagan magazines come and go.
Yeah, because Green Egg is online now, right?
We can say that Green Egg is online. It is not the magazine that it was, although they're working very hard, and I appreciate their efforts. But that had a hiatus of, I think, a whole decade, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
But Green Egg is online. The Beltane Papers went down this year, or last year. Goddessing is gone. Goddess Pages went online only, used to be in paper, and there's one other magazine in the UK. There are a couple of paper magazines in the United Kingdom that seem to be doing fine. There's a magazine called Pagan Dawn, which is put out by the Pagan Federation, and there's another one called Pentacle. So the UK still has two major papers, and I believe there's at least one and possibly two in Australia. But as far as I know, in the United States, it's Circle and us.
So besides your tenacity and your savvy as a businesswoman, are there any other secrets that you think contribute to Sage Woman being around so long since you took it over?
I would say, in terms of Sage Woman, and I think it's probably best to just focus on that because the other ones have morphed a lot, I think it's Sage Woman herself. I do not take credit for it. Sage Woman has a very specific voice and a very specific feel that I did not invent. And I have to say that although Carol Shebert started the idea based sort of on woman spirit, I would say that it's Linnea Weatherstone who created the Sage Woman that we know and love today. Sage Woman is a place of hope and healing in a rough world, and it has a very specific kind of tone that I think people find immensely valuable. And I think that's the reason we're still here, really. I don't think it's me. I don't think it's my business acumen. I do work really hard, and I've, you know, but a lot of other people have too. I think it's Sage Woman herself.
And so for someone who maybe hasn't found you, a new listener, for instance, mm-hmm. because I do have new people to the goddess,
mm-hmm.
you sort of described how it's different, but is there anything else you can put your finger on that, that sort of maybe better describes the tone?
Sure.
Or what is it not?
Well, first of all, Sage Woman is written first person. Okay. We don't do a lot of journalistic stories. It's all women telling their stories. Sage Woman is a women's circle in print.
Okay.
And that is an evergreen concept and something that we all need, whether we are gay or straight or transgender or whatever in terms of our orientation. All of us who identify as female, because that's what Sage Woman's about, need to connect. And Sage Woman provides a way of connecting, even though it's not very often, it's 2, 3, 4 times a year, hopefully four times this time this year. But it's very carefully put together. The illustrations are drawn specifically for the articles. They're all commissioned artwork. It's a way of us sharing our stories in print and feeling that we're a member of a community that cares about the goddess, about the earth, about each other, about ourselves. And to be perfectly candid, I have never seen anything like it anywhere. And that was what attracted me all those years ago in that bookstore to say I wanted to be connected with this magazine and to pick up the phone and call Linnea.
Okay.
And that's what's special.
So in all of these years, is there one particular issue or, I don't know, situation, story that stands out for you?
Oh, my goodness. Probably hundreds. It's kind of like asking a mom which kid she likes best. there's a story that I published in the current issue that I didn't have to do a thing to. I'm a pretty vigorous editor, and this was so amazingly well written that I don't think I changed a comma. It was absolutely the perfect Sage Woman story. And it's interesting because the woman is obviously a goddess worshiper, but it is a story about connecting to self and to nature. It's called Beachcombing. It's by, as it so happens, a woman who lives in Oregon named Mary Zelinka. And the illustrations are by Alana Moronic. And it's in the current issue. And it is just the perfect Sage Woman story. So I don't know how to describe that. She talks about driving to the beach for 3 days to be by herself at the ocean. She's had a really rough time in her life. And she goes to the beach every year. This is a true story. All the stories in Sage Woman are true. We don't publish fiction at all because we think it would be confusing to the reader. So this is what she does every year. She goes down to the beach. She rents a little house to be by herself, and she connects with the goddess in the ocean, in the sky, in the sea urchins, in whatever, you know, in the seagulls, in the animals that she sees, and the wind and the waves, and feels that she's healed. She has, you know, she's had serious problems with, I believe, her son, who is very depressed and often on the edge of possible, you know, doing something to himself. She has really, you know, these hard challenges that we all face these days. This is a tough time.
Yes, yes.
And she finds healing. And so that's an epitome of Sage Woman, is someone
it's
who's
heartfelt.
Actually
it's,
willing
it's
to share
felt.
That deep.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
It's
just,
it's
sincere.
Yeah.
Well, and I would imagine, you know, with some of the questions I get asked most often is, you know, people that are looking, you know, they want to know, what does it look like to be a goddess woman, to connect with goddess? So I think it always helps people to read other stories, and it sort of gives them a sense of, well, you know, I get that. That, you know, that works for me too.
Yeah. And one thing I think that also is special about Sage Woman is we try to be very inclusive. With the exception of the rattle, where I let people yell at me, but not much at each other, Sage Woman's tone is very welcoming. There's not a lot. I've been criticized over the years that we're not very political, which is true. We're not very political because that's not what I see Sage Woman's job as being. It's not that I'm not political myself. So when you come to those pages, you're going to find stories from people who hopefully it will resonate with you, and you will be able to kind of see how they found a way through, and maybe that will help you find a way through.
Gotcha. Absolutely. Well, Anne, we're about it's at that time we're going to have to wrap it up. But okay. I want to thank you for almost an hour tonight telling us about your life's work here, and I want to thank you for being there. Obviously, we have so few goddess magazines now anymore. It's that much more valuable. So. Thank you for hanging in there for for all of us everywhere. And it would be hard for me to think people don't know how to find you, but let's go ahead and give the website contact information anyway, just in case.
Sure, I would like to do both the website and the phone number, if I may.
Sure.
Some people don't do websites. It's sagewoman.com. Which is sagewoman.com. And the phone number is really easy. It's 888-SAGE-WOMAN, but some people use like numbers, so it's 888-724-3966. And anybody who wants to call in or send me an email, which you can find me online, I'd be happy to send you, put you on the mailing list for a copy of the next issue. I've sold out of the current one, but there'll be a new issue out in March. They just need to ask for it. Let me know that you heard me on the radio.
Okay. Well, Anne, we have emailed so many times. It's nice to now actually hear your voice.
Oh, thank you. You too.
Well, thank you so much, and stay warm there tonight, and I appreciate your time and the wisdom you shared with my listeners tonight.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate your time, and I hope that, that was helpful.
Okay. Talk to you soon.
Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. So if you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss goddess, the divine feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking, and the feminine consciousness, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just can and will save the world. And remember to stay tuned in till the end of the show and find out how to win some free goodies. Well, next up, waiting to talk to you and share her secrets to your ultimate physical and spiritual health, we have author and Reverend Victoria Javoyan. I want to read her bio for you. Author Reverend Victoria Javoyan, she's the executive director of the Joshua Tree International Retreat Center and the Dean LeMay Institute of Mental Physics. That's right. I got it right. Mental fit is physics. That's not a typo. She's a businesswoman and entrepreneur who founded the Alexandria Bookstore of Southern California. Artist and graphic designer, Victoria developed a career in the movie industry in her early years. She's been a lecturer, visionary, student of mysticism for over 25 years. She's the author of God as Mother and the soon-to-be-released New Dimensional Thinking and the Path of Selfless Love. So, Victoria, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm glad we finally got a chance to chat tonight. And you're going to be talking about, the key breaths of life, the eight
yes.
key breaths of life. Did you tell me that they're Tibetan in their origin?
Right, a little bit about the history. I don't know if that many people out there know about the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, but it's basically called the Institute of Mental Physics. Way back in, it started back in 1920. Well, let's see, they started building it in the 40s, early 40s. But the whole thing started way back in 1910. There was a man named Ding LeMay, Edwin J. Dingle, as he had been known at that time. And somehow he was just drawn to going to Tibet, to China, since he was very young. And finally he went as a correspondent. And when he got there, he noticed that there were certain individuals that were being given great reverence to. And they ended up being these Tibetan lamas. So he climbs the mountain Tibet, and he almost dies. And when he gets there, they say, "What took you so long?" Because they had thought that he was their one of their monks who had passed on. And so what they did is they kind of gave him a test, just like the Dalai Lama would take, where you'd lay out all the previous lama's things, like the bowls or his articles of clothing, and he would pick out which ones that had been his, and everything aligned. Now, you have to understand, at that time, they didn't how can I say this? They didn't have their arms open wide to Westerners. Let's just put it that way. And but the thing is that he was born in the West, and here was their brother Lama who had passed on, and he's a Westerner. So they figured, well, I guess it's time for the work to leave. Now all of this work that they had on these secret breath exercises had started over 1,000 years ago. And that was when Padmasambhava had pulled it from the University of Anala and then Ananda and then brought it over to there, had known that the warriors were coming in to take and go through and pillage everything, and so they wanted to protect the work. So they took it into Tibet, and because the terrain was so difficult to get to, and it hadn't been invaded for many, many years, so or ever at that point, that is. And so they kind of scattered all these different teachings, all these mystical teachings throughout China and through Tibet and all. And it just so happened that the one that Edwin J. Dingell was drawn to was the place where all the ancient breaths were left for protection. Under the protection of that group there. So he studied it, he learned it, learned all the different breaths and all these different things that they taught him. And then they said, okay, now, knowing that he was a Westerner, figured you better go back and start teaching the West. And that's what he did. And at first he started in New York and then eventually came to California, and then finally that's the history of how it got here. And what's really interesting, Karen, is that here in America, at the time he was alive, because he had passed on about in the 80s, at the time he was alive, he had brought it up to over 250,000 people doing these just magical breaths, okay, at that time. Now, currently, they actually, in India right now, they have over 250,000 people doing these breaths, and they call it Brahma Vidya there. And they call him, Edwin J. Dingell, Guru Ding LeMay. So It's ironic how they come here and do their pilgrimages, and then we go over there.
So how is this different from other breath work?
Well, basically, a lot of the different breaths that people use, yes, they're taking in prana and all, and they're stimulating the chakra system and the energy systems in the body. But what is so unique about this breath work is that it regenerates, not activates, but regenerates the glands of the body. And that's what makes it so unique. And even taking, there's one breath that a lot of your listeners will probably know, where just this is the standard guru breath where you just, you know, take your thumb and you put it on when your right nostril and you go left and right and left. But some of them may not know that just one little shift in the way you hold the body as you're doing it will make a huge difference upon the glands that work it. For instance, he has one breath called the harmonic breath. Now, that's not one of the 8 key breaths that he uses, but each breath correlates with one of the glands in the human body. The harmonic breath, however, that one that everybody does, left to right nostril, actually is working on stimulating energy, bringing oxygen into the lungs, etc. But in this case, the way you do it, just by doing certain stances, should I go into detail or I don't know?
I think so, so that we, you know, get a clearer
idea. Okay, it's a very easy thing to do. So say you're doing the one where you're doing left and right nostril. Most people sit down in meditative position and doing that. What we do is we stand, always with heels together for grounding, always with knees locked back, and buttocks tightened. Now, I know that in a lot of the different groups, they'll do a tightening of the anus, but you're not doing that here. You're actually just tightening the muscles of the butt, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And what happens is, by doing that stance with your knees locked back, your spine straight, your buttocks tight, your shoulders back, and you're going right to left, by just doing that simple little thing extra, the difference in the storage of the prana, which I'll get into a little bit in a minute, of that energy, bringing in the energy, is like night and day. It's an
you
extra,
mean the difference, the standing up position rather than
yes.
sitting down,
and
okay.
also the tightening of the buttocks and the knees locking back,
okay.
and the spine straight. It's that whole connection of all those different postures being put together, create and form a completely different pattern in a different dimension, because you've got the physical body lining up that actually activates this pattern.
Hmm. Well, now, Victoria, I'm going to get real kindergarten here
sure.
on you, because
no
some
problem.
Of my listeners may not have actually even heard about prana or breath work.
Yeah.
Maybe you need to talk a little bit, you know, as concisely as you can about what is the breath work and what is prana and why is
sure.
it important and,
okay.
you know.
Absolutely. Well, okay, first of all, there's this thing with the word prana. I mean, most people look at it as life force or that divine energy itself that flows through all in existence, okay? However, years ago I'd studied with a woman. Her name was Marie Bauer Hall. She was Manly P. Hall's wife. And she had the most concise definition of what prana was. Prana... Let's put it this way. Think of it this way. Prana activates, but God animates. Prana causes activity and accompanies life. The general understanding is that prana is the breath of life. Okay, that's what it is in Sanskrit. But most think prana is life itself, when in fact, what it is, it's the carrier of life. It's not the animating force inside. It is the vehicle through which life enters form. You see, prana itself is a fourth-dimensional thing, right? And form animating because it's carrying this life principle into form. Now, you're probably wondering, well, or some of your listeners may be wondering, well, why can't life just enter form? Well, the reason why is because life itself is a five-dimensional thing. Form is a three-dimensional thing. A five-dimensional thing can't enter a three-dimensional thing. It needs a fourth-dimensional thing, and hence comes prana. And prana... is like the veins, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that animating force of life, that five-dimensional life, travels through that prana, right?
Mm-hmm.
That prana then enters form, and then life can enter form itself through that prana.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it's so important.
And we thought all we were doing was taking a breath in and out. Who knew it was
yeah.
so complicated?
That's right. Well, you know, the interesting thing, what makes this also the breath work a little different is that, you see, certain breath techniques are the only way that certain glands in your body actually get to work. And so we're working with the endocrine system, okay? We're working with the glands. And these are your invisible guardians. They're the makers of your destiny. Because how well they secrete these fluids that organize and control and rejuvenate your body is the better they work, the healthier you feel, and the clearer you think.
Interesting. So, well, now you told me that there were eight key breaths, and there's
right.
also something called the creative breath. Is that one
right.
of the eight?
No, creative was an extra one.
Okay.
And
okay,
I love
so
it. I love it.
So there's nine breaths. Well, I'm not sure you can, you know, there's time for you to actually go through all of them tonight.
No.
But what did you want us to know about them? Because apparently there's classes. People can find out more information if they wanted to go into depth about this.
Absolutely. I would just like to say this, though. You know, I get calls every day of people calling me up and saying, thank you for teaching me this breath work. Because after you've done these eight key breaths, you don't even need coffee. I mean, you've got so much energy, you don't know what to do with. Okay, let's put it this way. I went to sleep 3 o'clock in the morning right now, and I had no coffee or cookies or anything else to speed me up. But just a few little breaths just before I go on, and you're just reactivated again.
Wow.
And I know, it's just very powerful. And I'll tell you something else. If you are around the age of 30 or more, this breath work is really for you. Because what it does is it clears your mind and keeps you focused. It really makes you feel like you're centered. You're like, each one of us is like a flicker of life, right? A flicker of light, that that God essence within us, right?
Mm-hmm.
When the way you breathe, the way I breathe, is basically fanning that flame within us.
Okay, so if you know these breath techniques, then
right.
you can get a raging fire going.
There you go. And that's
okay.
very important for the spiritual group as well. Because if you notice, many, many spiritual teachers have a tendency to get really either overweight or sickly or this or that, but at the same time, they're brilliant, right? They're brilliant,
mm-hmm.
shining individuals, but they may not feel well or this or that, and it's basically because they're not balancing the body. Their poor little body, they're taking in all that light or intelligence,
mm-hmm.
right, that information,
mm-hmm.
and downloading that all into a body, a physical
mm-hmm.
body. Because remember, our brain is there having to work through that all this coming outside has to go through our physical brain into our soul minds or our spirit minds, right? And,
mm-hmm.
and here we are pounding it with information when our poor little pea brains, they're just barely keeping up. But by using the breath, what it does is it fans that flame, and that is through which perfection comes. It perfects the body, the human vehicle. Then the vehicle, as it's perfected, can then absorb the higher information. So the more aware that you are aware of your own breath, right?
Mm-hmm.
The more aware you are of your own breath, the greater the intelligence can flow through that brain. The higher information comes through. It's like have you ever read a book where all of a sudden you're reading it and then you go back and reread it and you go, wow, I didn't see that the first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course.
Your brain has been conditioned. It upped it. You upped it a notch in its understanding. And that's what happens when you use the breath. It raises the vibratory rate of the brain itself so that the higher information can flow through and be digested by the human body.
So let me ask you this.
Or
you said this is great for somebody in their 30s, but I'm just mm-hmm. curious. My mind is starting to go, well, how would this affect, say, somebody in their 50s or 60s?
No, that's what I meant. Yeah, did I say that? No, I meant 30 or more.
Okay,
30 or more. Oh, absolutely. Are you kidding? Oh, my gosh, we get people in here that are in their 90s, and when they shake your hand, you're going, ow, 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 and they've been doing this breath work all their lives. It's really beautiful to see.
I'm wondering, just off the top of my head
uh-huh.
here, if there's any connection to statistics that might show people who do this might not get dementia.
Oh, absolutely. There's no question about that. He has a memory breath that actually does two things. One thing is obviously the brain and memory, remembering all that stuff. But on a spiritual level, and this is what I love so much about it, because each gland, as you're regenerating it
mm-hmm.
and rebuilding it, what it does is it works on us. It's like an alchemist. It works on a physical level and an alchemical level, or spiritual. And
mm-hmm.
so say the memory breath on one hand helps you remember where you put your keys, and then on a spiritual level, it helps you remember the reason why you came in, the purpose of why you took on this lifetime. And I remember reading in the book, when I first read it, it had all these letters from all these individuals. Oh, my gosh, yes, I heard the tiny, small voice inside say, my purpose was, thank you. They were writing to Dingle May back in that time. And I'm reading all these old letters and things, and I was stunned. And I thought, oh, yeah, sure, it's not going to happen to me. So there I was, sitting at the self-realization services one day, totally not even thinking about a thing or anything. And I'd done my breathwork, of course, that morning, and then I went in there. And sure enough, there was that little small voice, your purpose is da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was stunned.
Wow.
And I know. What can I say? I mean, you have to understand something. I've been studying anything from alchemy, Blavatsky, Kirchhoff, Steiner's works, and all these amazing things all my life. But here was this simple, simple little practice that really has helped me in my life, because all it becomes is just information. But I wanted to know, how am I going to live? What is going to help me on a daily day thing?
Well, and I would imagine, I mean, you know, you and I are close to the same age. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get to the point where, you know, there's so many things that you want to still do in your life, you want to accomplish, and you wonder if you're going to have time to do it all. But if you're feeling like this, that thought probably doesn't even enter your mind anymore.
No, you don't. You don't, because you're not even a time, you don't have time. Time becomes irrelevant. Because you feel you're always in the moment of now, right? So you're not worried about the future. You're not worried about the past. It just focuses you. It keeps you in this now state. And remember, when you're in the now, you're in love. You're in love with every moment. I mean, that's what we're building towards, right? We're in love with the moment. We're in love with trying to get to that state of beingness. And when you're in that state of selfless love or passion over what you're doing, you are out of time. You are completely out of anything that even reflects time. You have all the time in the world to do whatever it is, and you feel the immortality within you. You don't see an ending to anything.
So before we start to run out of time, talk about the 8 breaths.
Okay.
And I can give you about 5 minutes.
Okay, you got it. All right, what I'm going to do is this. I'm just going to kind of go over the creative breath. Now, understand something. There are courses, right? First of all, we're going to have a couple of classes online. We do this online classes, and then I have another class coming up in Hollywood. And what we can do is have your listeners, if they'd like to, you know, sign, get on our mailing list. That's at jtrcc.org. That's J, like Joshua Tree, jtrcc.org. And if they go on there and sign up, they'll find out when that next class is coming up within the next few weeks. And basically what we're going to do is this. We go into detail, and I can see you, you can see me, because it's something like a Skype, but it's better than Skype that we work through. And I can even correct people's postures and all that. I just love the new technology. So anyway, and then if you prefer it in person, then I can let those of you who know I'm usually in either Redondo Beach or I'm in Hollywood area doing the classes. Basically, there are 8 key breaths, but there's also the one that you use as prep. You know how before you're going to run, you start doing stretches?
Mm-hmm,
well, the harmonic
yeah.
breath is the one that we do stretches with, okay? And by the way, not to jump around on you, but I know earlier tonight I just spoke about how people use your thumb and they alternate the nostrils. The first thing that I tell everybody to do is look in the mirror find out what nostril you use primarily. Because if you use your left nostril primarily, and we're talking in a 24-hour period, one or the other is going to be used more than the other. If it's the left nostril, it means that you use your body to get through life. But if you use your right nostril, it means you use your nervous system to get through life. Does that make sense? Okay, you got that so far.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means that if you're using your body, it means that your nervous system is jeopardized. That means you need to build up your nervous system. If you are strong on the right side, the right nostril, then it means that your nervous system is really strong, but your body can't handle the pushing that you're doing to it. You see the difference?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when you're doing that alternating breathing, everybody, regardless of whose technique you're using, you always want to do extras on the side that you are that lacks.
Okay.
Okay, lacks the strength. Now, if your left nostril is stronger, it means that your pituitary gland is stronger, because your pituitary gland secretes about 9 hormones into the body, right? So it makes your body strong. But if it's your right nostril that you use, like myself, it means our nervous system is really strong, and it also has a very powerful pineal gland, which we call the third eye, if we look at it in an alchemical way, a spiritual way. The third eye is highly developed. So whichever side your listeners breathe most out of tells them which side they need to focus on and make sure they're reactivating, okay? Because those glands up there, particularly the pineal and the pituitary gland. They have a tendency to just kind of, well, the pineal gland lies dormant until you start activating it. And through meditation, even, we can activate as well. But what you always have to remember is that when you do this AT breaths, when you do any of the breaths, whether it's my technique, anybody, or our technique, or anybody else's technique, always remember that you absolutely must meditate. I don't even care, I tell people, if you even do it only 3 minutes, I don't care, as long as you meditate after you do breath work, because it allows the body to absorb the prana, and that's the key to all of this.
Okay.
Now, the reason why, okay, there are 8 key breaths, but the reason why I'm going to teach them the creative breath is because this is not one of the 8 keys, but I found it really exciting because in the creative breath, it is just that what it says. It's the creative breath. It's where you're creating something to manifest in your life. And I started doing this creative breath about, I think it was like a couple of years ago. And then every year I have new things that I'm using the breath for. And so I started doing the creative breath for about 6 months on this other thing, on certain things that I needed in my life. And sure enough, they all came to manifest, but one. But everything else came through. So the reason why I'm saying this is because I get so excited because I've had a lot of mail coming in telling me, oh, yeah, the creative breath worked. And with 2012 and everything, it is so highly critical that we breathe. It is so highly critical. You know how meditation got really hot? Well, first there was yoga, and then all of a sudden meditation got really hot. And now you're going to find breath is the key now. You see, all our bodies are being like tweaked, 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 and it's all being tweaked to that point where that whole
It's fine-tuning things.
Exactly.
Let me give you a time check here. We probably
sure.
have about 5 to 7 minutes.
Okay. All right. We'll do the creative breath then.
Yeah, we're getting a little bit past the half hour mark here.
Oh, you got
so
it.
I just wanted to let you know.
So what you're going to do in this particular one is you're sitting in lotus position on the floor. So the buttocks must be flat on the floor on this thing, right foot over the left. What you're basically doing is your hands are on your knees, and you think for a moment what it is that you wish to create in your life. And then what you do is you hold your hands straight out, as if you were like a robot, straight out with your hands open, and
mm-hmm.
you're visualizing that which you want to bring into your life. And then you close your hands down on that vision. And once you close your hands down on that vision, you exhale and then you inhale. And as you inhale, you bring your fists back towards you and then tuck them under your arms. But you're breathing that vision in until you feel exactly that which you see. You put yourself in there and you're holding your breath and you're in that vision. You're experiencing it, you're tasting it, you're smelling it, you're feeling it, and that's what's really, really important about this breath, and that's why they call it the creative breath. You're literally inhaling in the vision, and you're becoming one with it, and you're feeling in it, so that you're in the midst of your own vision.
Oh, wow.
It is so powerful.
Well, and I'm realizing that we're not going to have time to get into the other 8
key
breaths.
No.
But Victoria, let's talk a little bit about you know how people can find out more about this because
sure.
I can imagine that my listeners are saying, Karen, no, you have to keep her on longer, but I can't tonight. I have to make a class, so I'll have
no
to
problem.
Have you back. But
That's
in
fine,
the meantime, so not to not to let them hang
sure.
In the event. They want to know more about this before I can have you back on the show.
Sure.
How do they find out about it?
I'm going to give them a phone number that they can call. It's 760-365-8371. That's 760-365-8371. And I would just like to say one more thing, if we have time.
Sure.
To do it really quick.
Yeah, sure.
I want everybody to know that I've been like the purveyor of lost works. And I don't know why this keeps happening in my life. I did it with Marie Hall, which was Manly P. Hall's wife. I found her works buried in the basement and rotting in the attic and this and that. And I come over here, and it's the same thing with this guy, Edwin J. Stengel's work. So for some reason, I've been put in this position to bring this work back to everybody's hands. I'm telling you, really seriously, when you do this breath work, I had this one woman that just called me this morning, and she's telling me how she's doing seven of them, and I have to say, no, you're only supposed to be doing three at a time. And she says, I've got more, and she's 78. And she says, I've got more energy than I know what to do. I go, no, I'm so sorry. You're just going to have to listen to me here. And I go, you've got to do three. She goes, okay, I'll do four. I said, no, you're going to do three. So I'm just letting you know that I am so thankful to have found this. When it changes the way you feel about life and about yourself, breathing is so important.
And what better gift can you give yourself, quite frankly?
That's right.
And
it's free.
Except maybe love.
And
you know,
it's free.
Absolutely. Well, Victoria, I'm so annoyed with myself because I feel like, you know, we were just getting going here, and even though we've been chatting for about a half hour, I feel like I've just teased myself and my listeners. So I apologize for that, but promise me you'll come back and we'll get into this in a little bit more depth.
Absolutely. I was going to ask you, Karen, is there any possibility of our actually next time maybe what we could do is set it up so that people can just, we could, as you and I are speaking, they can see it, the postures and everything right on that particular thing. We may be able to arrange something like unique like that.
Well, I don't know if we have the capability to do any visuals, you know, because it is still, you know, I can't really bring up pictures or anything
gotcha.
Like that.
Okay.
So we can't really do that, but at least we could, if you wanted to, we could take the time to walk through the eight breaths.
Absolutely.
But I think what I'd rather do is allocate a show, you know, an entire show maybe just for this,
okay.
especially if there's a lot of, you know, listener interest, because this turned out to be a lot more in-depth than I realized. And it's so important that I think it's definitely worth allocating a whole show to and just have you as the primary guest.
Thank you. Well, I'll tell you, it's not for myself, truly. Like I said, I've seen a lot of work. I've gone through a lot of things in life, and it's so simple. It's so simple, and it prepares the spiritual growth of us. It prepares the body and helps it to keep up with what we're absorbing right now. And with all that's going on, we need to stay centered.
Okay. Well, listeners, you have my promise. I'm going to get on the phone or email with Victoria tomorrow, and we're going to set up a special time for her to come back and go through these eight key breaths so you can really get a sense of what she's talking about. But in the meantime, she gave you the phone number to call and the website for the Joshua Tree Retreat Center. Victoria, why don't you give that?
Sure. It's jtrcc.org. JTRCC.org. Just jump onto the mailing list there, or you can reach me at 760-365-8371.
And so you said there's online courses. Are they in process
yes.
right now or coming
yes.
up?
We're going to be coming up with a brand new. It's two Saturdays for only 2 hours each time, and very reasonably priced. Totally reasonable because we want this to get out, and that's it. And we'll be letting everybody know what the dates are on it. And we also have little books and little pamphlets here that show all the pictures of the breaths and how to do it. And so if they wanted to get a book, they're $10, and another one is $23.95. So either one. We do have books on this as well. So for those of you who are interested in that, we're working on videos right now.
Oh, videos would be great.
Yeah,
and, well,
or
and I
video
want to hear
CDs
more,
now.
and I want to hear more about the classes in Redondo Beach in Hollywood because I can go there much easier than driving a Joshua Tree.
Oh, absolutely. I'm just so excited. I can hardly wait to teach you because I know you're going to be with more energy and you're going to go, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that.
Oh, God, you know, I already have so many lists now. I'll have 20 lists then. but your energy is contagious. I mean,
oh,
you know, you're a living example of what happens when you do these breaths. What better salesperson?
Oh, thank you. Well, it's just the passion for it because it's so simple. That's the key. It's just simple, but, you know, it's filled, it makes you feel like there's hope and
okay.
there's love.
Well, and we certainly need that. Well, Victoria, I'm sorry to have to cut this short tonight, but we will pick it up and we'll get into it in more depth shortly, okay? And so
we'll
thank
do,
you.
And thank you so much for your time, and thank you, listeners, for sticking in there with us.
Okay. All right.
All right.
Good night, Victoria. I'll be in touch with you soon.
Good night. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye. Well, listeners, as I said, I do have to sort of cut things short tonight. Normally the show goes on for another 45 minutes, but I actually have a class tonight. I am going to the Kabbalah Center here in Los Angeles. They're going to be talking about prophecies for 2012, so I want to hear what they have to say, and I'll come back and I'll tell you about it. So to conclude tonight's show, in the spirit of sharing and being generous, which is the goddess way, you still have the opportunity to win a copy of some of my past interviews. You'll be the winner if you're the first to email me at KarenTate108@ca.rr.com. Tell me a little bit about yourself, why you'd like to have a copy of the interviews. Give me your mailing address, and you'll be the winner. Now, be sure to follow those instructions. That's part of winning the CD. So, my fine listeners, goddess advocates across the globe, that concludes our show for tonight. So until next week, when we have Starhawk on the show and Zohara Hieronymus, may goddess embrace you in her golden wings. Good night.
Direction. It's up to me to block it out. It's up to me.